Thank you very much, Rabbi Schachter. Before I introduce the second shir this morning, I would like to bring your attention to an upcoming Kolo Yom Rishon Yom Iyun at Yeshiva University on December 9th. The topic of the Yom Iyun is Judaism's encounter with other cultures, and the keynote address will coincidentally be given by Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, and will be featuring shirim from Rabbi Dr. Ephraim Kannerfogel, Dr. Aaron Kohler, Mrs. C.B. Nugrishel, Dr. Rona Novick, Rabbi Yonah Reese, Ms. Shuli Taubes, and Rabbi Mordechai Willen. There are flyers on the table if they're still out there, if you'd like some more information. Additionally, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that there is a Kol Yom Rishon for men and a Midrashet Yom Rishon for women every Sunday morning at Yeshiva University in Washington Heights. On Sunday morning, there is usually no traffic, so it takes around 35 to 40 minutes to get there from Brooklyn, depending on how loosely you define the term speed limit. And it is well worth the travel. Finally, there are publications of the newest YU to go on Hanukkah on the table outside with many interesting articles from YU, Rebbeim, and faculty. Past to go articles as well as Kolel and Midrash Yom Rishon Shiurim as well as thousands of other Shiurim can be found for free on yutorah.org. Our second speaker this morning is Dr. David Palkovitz. Dr. Palkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration of Yeshiva University, and is an instructor in pastoral psychology, pastoral counseling at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Before coming to Yeshiva University, he served as the director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine, and was clinical professor of psychology at NYU. Dr. Palkovitz has written and lectured on a broad range of psychological topics related to the Jewish community and the community at large. On a personal note, while I mentioned before that the mark of a great teacher is the regret one feels that he should have taken more classes with that teacher, the other mark of a great teacher is when someone actually does take as many classes as possible with that teacher. Through my time at Azrieli and at Reitz, I was privileged to take 5 courses with Dr. Palkovitz, but I still wish I could have taken more. His personal and engaging style, along with his deep insights into Torah and psychology, and of course his fascinating personal stories, had a lasting impact on me and anyone who hears him. The fact that I am currently pursuing a doctorate in psychology is largely due to the impact that he has had on my life. It is my privilege to introduce Dr. David Palkovitz, who will be speaking to us this morning on the topic of giving thanks, Jewish and psychological perspectives on gratitude. Dr. Palkovitz.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that warm introduction. Rabbi Schiffman got A's in all those courses. You're welcome to any new courses. And Rishus Rabbi Tokayer, who I just found out is a relative, so it's always nice to find a family I didn't even know I had, especially such a chashiv relative. And Rishus Rabbi Schiffman, everybody else. I feel surrounded by friends. I feel a connection to almost everybody here who I was able to talk to just before. Let me start with a story, because hopefully what I'm going to develop in the course of my time here is I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the difficulty of maintaining Hakara Satov, which, as we just heard from Rabbi Schiffman, is the core midah that we have to develop. It's the essence of being called a Jew, is Hakara Satov. In fact, it says in the Gemara that La'asid Lavo, every karban will be batal. Actually, it's in a medrash. Every karban will be abolished. The one sacrifice that will not be abolished is the karban todah. That's how central gratitude is in terms of our granting it such basic importance. But it's much harder than you think. So I'm going to develop what's difficult. Which way? Like that? Okay. Got it. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to develop a little bit about how hard it is. I'm going to talk about some of the psychological research. Then I'm going to give some practical recommendations illustrated with stories. But let me start with a story that's from week before last. Week before last, I spent in Germany, in Frankfurt, Germany. And let me tell you how a nice Jewish boy could come to spend a week in Frankfurt, Germany. A few years ago, I was giving a talk at some medical ethics conference in Switzerland. Somebody came over to me afterwards and said, you know, for the last six decades, since 1945, companies who benefited from slave labor during the Holocaust sponsor a conference in Frankfurt for Holocaust survivors who stayed in Europe. There are about 4,000 of them, and their therapists, and second generation. It's to give support to this population. It's a whole different experience when a survivor stays in Germany or even stays in Europe, and there's an interesting story behind all of them. And the person says, but you know, we don't know anything about Judaism. We know absolutely nothing about being Jewish because Hitler robbed us of our Jewish education. And then the Russians, who were the therapists, Stalin and communism, robbed them of a Jewish education. So they said, I have a question to ask you. She says, as we heard you speak, it came to us, maybe Judaism has something to offer in terms of our perspective on suffering in the Holocaust. The Jewish thought, this head of the conference asked me, have anything to offer? Because it might be really interesting to have you come. Fine. You know, to me, it was an amazing, amazing question. I hadn't even thought that you could even think about such a thing. You know, it's so central to my education and the way I've spent my career specializing in trauma in the secular world, but then trying to integrate that wisdom. So I went. And the first time I went was a couple of years ago. And I get up to give the first talk, and it's being translated. There are three translators behind the glass booth. It's being translated into German, French, and Russian. Everybody has a headphone on, except that instead of saying that I have this Strauss chair in psychology and education, they get a little wrong. They said, he purchased for himself a chair from the Strauss family. And I realized everything I'm saying is being translated in some way that's a little different than I intend. But after the first talk, a line forms of the various people, the 400 participants in the conference, a long line. And they wait their turn, they come to the microphone. The first woman comes up, and she starts speaking in Yiddish. And I found out later she hadn't spoken in Yiddish since her liberation in 1945. And she shares with me and with the audience the story of the day that Mengele chose her to go to the right, her to live, and her siblings, if I remember correctly, I think it was nine siblings, to go to their death. And I found out later that it wasn't until she heard this series of talks that integrated Jewish thinking with suffering that she was able to bring herself to talk about that horror beyond belief. Then, practically every person behind her on the line said a variation on the theme of, do you know what you have? You may take it for granted, but do you know what a gift it is to be given a Jewish education that allows you to take the wisdom of Judaism and bring it into everyday life, or to bring it into psychology, or to bring it to inform day-to-day stresses? And the reality was, I always took it for granted. This room, being able to talk, to hear a brilliant talk like my former chavrusa just gave, okay? To be able to talk now about integrating positive psychology and integrating what we know from research on gratitude into Jewish thinking, which is actually a much deeper and more satisfying way of looking at things. We take it for granted. We have no hakara sato for it, because the eye sees only what the mind knows. And unless we at times are able to take a step back and get grateful for that which we don't even know we have, our life is going to be somewhat more superficial. Story number two. There was a paper that had to be given at a child psychiatry meeting in Hawaii. This is back when I was at North Shore Hospital. And I volunteered to go. I was a nice guy. I figured, okay, you know, not everybody has to go. The hospital is willing to pay for one of us. So I said, I'll go. And I must have done it a little better than everybody else. Of course, everybody wanted to go. And I go to this place that's unbelievably magnificent. I don't know how many of you have ever been there. It's an unbelievably beautiful place. And I cut a session, and I'm sitting outside looking at the sunset in a way that was just beyond magnificent. There's a waterfall in the background. It's a magnificent hotel. And I'm alone. It's just me and a hotel worker. And the hotel worker is just, you know, puttering around there. And I look at him. I say, I just can't even imagine what it must be like to work in such a magnificent setting. It's unbelievable. What's it like to have a job in a place? I said, I've never seen anything like this. And he sort of like comes out of a stupor. He looks at me, totally puzzled. And he says, sir, he says, I don't see what you see, but I got news for you. I dread coming to work Monday morning as much as the next day. It's hard. Gratitude is hard because almost anything that we're surrounded by on a regular basis, what happens is we develop a habit of, it's called habituation. The Bali Musar called it hergel. You get used to everything. There's a beautiful Chovos Halvavos. I won't take the time to review with you, but he actually says this. He says, even in terms of our ability to have Hakaras HaTov, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for life, he says, because we're constantly surrounded by it. You know, to say, Al Misecha Shebechol Yomi Manu, and to really have Kavana in terms of talking about the daily miracles of just life is very, very hard. So what the talk is about is first to talk about the benefits, and I'm going to make a couple of very basic recommendations about how to overcome hergel, about how to overcome habituation, how to develop a habit of attention to what we have surrounding us. Because when you do it, it changes your life. Here's the psychology. Psychology says, to the extent that you bring Hakaras HaTov into your life, you become happier. To the extent that you teach your children or grandchildren Hakaras HaTov, two things happen. They, first of all, by their being grateful, the person who's helping them is more likely to help them in the future. And perhaps more importantly, when you teach gratitude to somebody, they're more likely to pay it forward by doing chesed for somebody else. It's an important issue to realize. It's not a frill. It's actually a necessity. We also know, for example, that it has health benefits. They're beginning to figure out why it has health benefits. And I'll just tell you a series of studies that came out in the last year or so. I don't think I necessarily talked about this in the class that Rabbi Schiffman took, but it goes like this. If you, before you fall asleep, discipline yourself to have thoughts about something you're grateful for. You could try this tonight, okay? Or now, actually, okay? So if you're trying to nod off, have a little nap a little earlier, okay? So here's what you do. Think about something in your life you're grateful for. If your pre-sleep thoughts are about Hakaras HaTov, and you could put yourself into the zone of gratitude, three things happen. You fall asleep more quickly, you sleep better, and you feel more rested on the next day. And they think that that's one of the pathways that explains why gratitude and developing gratitude and overcoming the habituation seems to be associated with less illness, with, in general, not just more happiness, but a higher quality of life in terms of health. Now, next point before I go to actual recommendations. The next point has to do with what we're finding happens because of the stress-reducing properties of gratitude. We just had a hurricane. I know that this immediate neighborhood, thank God, wasn't as deeply impacted, but some neighborhoods in Brooklyn were. But I've had the opportunity since the hurricane to meet with four groups of people who were very deeply impacted in the five towns, just throughout the metropolitan area. And one of the things that I find myself talking about is very tied to gratitude. Here's what the research shows. After 9/11, some people reacted with rage, with anger at what happened. Totally understandable. Some people are responding to the hurricane with anger at everything from FEMA to the utility companies or whatever. Totally okay. Totally fine and totally maybe even adaptive. But what they find in the research after 9/11 is if over the long run you're able to have less of the psychological space in your head taken up with anger and more taken up with hakaras hatov and gratitude for what you have, gratitude for getting power back on, gratitude for having family who's able to support you and give you a place to stay, gratitude for the incredible outpouring of chesed after this kind of natural disaster. And then you see people who don't have the support system that we have. Turns out that when you're able to develop that habit of gratitude, your trajectory of healing and dealing with that kind of stress is much, much more rapid. I'm going to tell you the story of two brachos. Again, going back to my experience in Frankfurt 2 weeks ago. Share with you two stories. There was a survivor who was an unusually cheerful man, an unusually positive, optimistic man. He had an energy around him that everybody wanted to be around him. And I was talking to him a lot. And I go over to him and I ask him a question that I almost always get an incredible answer to. I quoted Chazal who say, Ma'at min ha'or doch harbe min ha'choshech. Little sparks of light push away a lot of darkness. And I said, I'm blown away by your optimism. I know you went through horrible suffering in Auschwitz. I said, what was your source of light during those horrible years? How did you get through? He smiles, and he says, I'll tell you exactly what it was. And he vividly describes to me what it was like. He says, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, the Nazis would come in, and they'd have their dogs, and they'd wake us up, and they throw us out into the freezing cold. If we didn't do it quickly enough, they'd shoot us or set the dogs on us. And he vividly described this horrific, horrific torture that was the beginning of every day. He said, you know what got me through? He said, was the Friday night bracha. Is I was able to imagine the bracha my father would give me when he benched me Friday night. He said, I'd feel his hands resting on my head. I feel the embrace of my father. He said, I feel the warmth of his breath enveloping me, and that got me through. Amazing. So I shared this story, and there was a survivor in the audience, and he was waiting for me afterwards, and he says, you know, I hear what you're saying. He says, but I got news for you. He says, I have a whole different reaction. He said, the other night, this wasn't in Frankfurt, this story happened back here. This happened actually in California. He said, the other night, I was at my son's house, and my son was benching Friday night my grandchildren. And I couldn't get out of my head my rage at Hitler, that here my grandchildren have the benefit of a father's love and a father's bracha, and I never had that when I was their age. And I can't let go of it. And who could judge him? I certainly can't judge him. But I got news for you. It was clear to me that the person who's doing better was the first gentleman I told you about, not the second. The person who's psychologically doing better. Now, some of that is just you're born with a certain ability to always see the glass of water as half full, not half empty. But I'm going to try to make an argument that maybe you could discipline yourself to overcome that tendency and learn how to focus on what you have instead of on what you don't have. And that brings me to the core of what I want to talk about, which is a couple of recommendations from positive psychology. I'll illustrate them with stories about how to develop the habit of attention. I'll start with what one of the major authors on the psychology of gratitude talks about, a guy named Dr. Kretsch. Here's what he says. He says, imagine that tomorrow morning, no, that's not good, where it's Thursday. Imagine Monday morning, you're getting ready for work. Your alarm clock doesn't work. You have it set to the Thanksgiving schedule, so it doesn't go off Monday morning. As a result, you get up 2 hours later. You know, every day you're on vacation, people get up an hour or so later. So you get up, it's already, instead of you usually get up at 7 or at 6, you're getting up at 9. And you're rushing to work, you rush into your car, you quickly are rushing onto the highway, and you get into a fender bender, you get into an accident. And then you finally get to your office, and you can't find your regular parking spot is taken by somebody. And then you finally walk into your office, it's already early afternoon, and your boss is furious at you. He says, that's scenario number one. Now, he says, imagine that what happens this Monday morning is what happens every Monday morning. Your alarm clock goes off on time. You get to work with normal traffic patterns. You have your normal spot waiting for you. And you walk into the office at 9 a.m. He says, how many people think to be grateful for a smooth sequence of events on a Monday morning? He says, that's the challenge. And that's what positive psychology comes to answer, that whole new field. So I'm going to share with you three approaches, and think about it. Just think about it. Think about maybe if there are ways to bring this into your life. What I do with my students now in one of the classes I teach is I change the way I used to teach it. Now I give everybody exercises to do every week in each midah that we learn about in positive psychology, and then have them actually implement these exercises, and it's changed the quality of the class, and now it's actually changing lives. People, you know, write these unbelievable papers about what happens when they implement the various recommendations we have for each midah. So here's recommendation number one. Recommendation number one is based on the idea that sometimes to overcome something, you have to develop it into a habit. You have to make it into part of the fabric of your life. But this first recommendation is a little different. It's about either writing a letter to somebody who's done a lot for you, who you've never expressed how grateful you are to them. The research shows the following. The more you owe somebody else, the less likely you are to be grateful to them. We're very likely to be grateful to somebody who on the BQE or on the belt helps us to change a flat. We're going to have tremendous hakaras hatov to a stranger helping us. But to be grateful to a mother, to a father, to a child, to a sibling, to a friend, much, much harder. And there's actually exactly the opposite of what one would expect to happen is exactly what happens. The more we owe, the less cognizant we are of what we owe. So here what they have you do is they have you either pay a gratitude visit to somebody with a specific idea of telling them how much you owe them or to write them a letter. It's transformative. And I'll tell you a story from my daughter, one of my daughters. One of my daughters, when she was in high school, she's in 10th grade, and she loves learning Nach. She loves learning Nevi'im. And she's passionate about it. And she's just, her passion is catchy. And she happens to be talking to her Nach teacher, and she says to her, you know, the person who turned me on to Nach was I had a fourth grade Nach teacher, and ever since I had him, I'm in love with the subject. She just can't get enough of it. She's constantly learning it, looking at Mefarshim, going to lectures, whatever she could do to grow in that area. To this day, she's older now, it's still a passion of hers. So the teacher, much to her credit, looks at her and says, does he know? My daughter looks at him and says, what are you talking about? She says, does he know how he transformed your day-to-day life? And my daughter looks at him like at her like she's crazy and says, what are you talking about? And she says, look, she says, I'm going to arrange for you to be off from the next your next subject, your next period. She marches her into the school office at this yeshiva. She says, they make a couple of phone calls together. They find that 2 years earlier, he had moved to Eretz Yisrael to teach there. They make a few more phone calls, and my daughter sits down and writes him an email saying, look, you transformed my life. There isn't a day that the passion and love of Nevi'im that you taught me does an impact on my life and inform who I am. And I'm just writing this email to thank you for it. That night, when she gets home, she has waiting for her an email from this former Rebbe of hers saying, you have no idea what you did for me. He says, I've been having a very tough time teaching in Eretz Yisrael. It's not so easy here. And I was beginning to think I have to find another way of making a living. I was even beginning to think of coming back to the United States. Since I was in a state where I just wasn't doing so great. And your email reminded me why I went into chinuch. And your email actually has given me a new sense of purpose and drive in terms of continuing what I do. I don't even know how I could ever thank you. Do you know how what that did for my daughter? You know how long it took? I would say the whole thing from beginning to end, 20 minutes. At most 20 minutes, till they found where he was. It's just one or two phone calls. And the email didn't take that long. And it made all that difference. We have to figure out how to take a step back, how to think about who do we owe the most to, and how do we figure out a way to communicate that to them? It's transformative. That's take-home message number one. Take-home message number two, which again I'll illustrate with a story, but I'll tell you what it is first, is the more common intervention. It's called a count your blessing exercise. Here's what psychologists find. They take different groups. They've done this with kids. They've done it with adults. So let's say they have a group of kids. They say, write down five things from the previous week that you're grateful for. And then they have a comparison group. They actually have two comparison groups. But the comparison group is basically, yes, write down five significant events that happened to you this week that you want to share. They then follow them over a 10-week period. And they find that those who write about the five things they're grateful for, it transforms the next 10 weeks. They're happier. They exercise more. Why, I don't know. Okay? They just feel better. They feel better during that 10-week period. And interestingly, this is just by doing it once a week. We're not talking about doing it every day. Just a once a week count your blessing exercise is transformative. Now, here's what the research shows. Those of you who are here and really listening to this, if you're like other groups, here's what the research on the psychology of change shows. One third of you will say, okay, I was sort of half listening to him, half dozing off, nice relaxing morning. I expended most of my attention on the first talk, which had more substance to it, which it did. I loved it. But yeah, fine, nice, but it's not going to change at all what you do, which is fine. That would put you in a third. A third of you may take one or two of the recommendations I'm making, leave here, and even try them a little bit. But if I talk to you a month from now, or 2 months from now, or certainly 6 months from now, you'll go back to baseline. That's the second third. Then there's the third, who the research shows, if this is striking a chord in you, you will do some of these recommendations, and it will not stay at high a level over the long run, but there might be some permanent change in your ability to experience Hakaras HaTov over the long run. What does the research show differentiates between group one, group two, and group three? It's that group three makes it into a habit. Group three ritualizes it. So what does that mean? For example, on Count Your Blessings, if you start having around your table Friday night, going around saying, tell me one thing from the week you're grateful for. It turns out by making that into a ritual, your kids will hate it. You have teenagers or teenage grandchildren at home, they're going to want to kill me. Don't tell them my name. Don't tell them how to get a hold of me. And certainly don't give them my email, okay? But eventually, it starts to become part of the fabric. And it does two things. It helps you become more in touch with things that you have Hakaras HaTov for. It helps your family or your guests know things you have Hakaras HaTov for. So it increases knowledge of what touched your heart from the previous week, which the research shows improves marriages and improves parenting. Detailed knowledge of each other's lives is a great buffer against the stress of the week. It's a simple recommendation. Here's my story. I told you I do work in the area of trauma. So that's my secular hat, is doing that kind of work. I was on the team that developed the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, one of the teams, DSM-IV team, and I've spent most of my career doing research and writing in terms of related areas of trauma. Because of that, I get invited after traumas to different places. So Katrina, I was there. After the tsunami, I was in Sri Lanka. But of course, during the Second Intifada, I was there a lot in Eretz Yisrael. And I had an incredibly intense couple of weeks in Eretz Yisrael at the height of the Second Intifada. I was doing things like working with the death notification squad, the people who would actually go, the mental health people, who would have to tell people, we just had terrible news, you lost your father, your mother, your child, your spouse, whatever it might be. I can imagine having a worse tafkid in life than having to do that if you were on that team. And they were totally burned out. They needed somebody outside. They knew much more about it than I ever will, thank God. But they just needed somebody from the outside. So I spent two intense weeks traveling around to the various trauma therapists in Eretz Yisrael and working with them. And from there, I had to go to the UK. I had to go to England, where Chief Rabbi Lord, Rabbi Dr. Sachs, what is it, the Lord Sachs, had invited me to spend 2 days with the rabbis of the shuls that are under his leadership. They were having a retreat in Bournemouth, England, and I was going to be the visiting scholar. It was an amazing 2 days. By the way, on the program, there's something called rabbinic cricket. You haven't lived till you've seen rabbinic cricket. You have these bearded rabbis dressed up in suits, and they play rabbinic cricket. I can see it becoming a televised sport. It was something, I can't get those images out of my mind. It was amazing. It was amazing. So, I'm in the taxi leaving Yerushalayim from those intense 2 weeks. I'm on my way to Ben-Gurion to catch the plane to Heathrow. And I remembered that I had been invited to a good friend's daughter's wedding in Yerushalayim. I'd said no, because it was too tight, the connection. But I figured, look, you only live once. So I tell the cab driver, I'll pay you for your waiting time. Let me just run in. I wanted to run in and say Mazel Tov. And I run into this hotel. It turns out the chuppah was already taking place in the back of the hotel, outside. And it overlooked the chomot of Yerushalayim. It was overlooking the ancient walls of the old city, and the sun was setting. And the temperature was perfect. It was a perfect 70 degrees. And part of the miracle of that chasana was nobody's cell phone went off. I'd never seen such a thing. Everybody was transfixed, and on top of that, it was the happiest chasana and kala I ever saw in my life. The kala was jumping up and down with extreme joy. It was an amazing, amazing, really a spiritual, beautiful experience. Tears of joy almost everybody had. It was amazing. So as I think about it, that image is burned in my head. And I was just so happy I went. And I run back in the cab. I just make the plane to go watch rabbinic cricket. And then I come back Friday afternoon, land in JFK just in time to make it to my house for Shabbos, and I'm emotionally depleted from those horrible 2 weeks in Eretz Yisrael. I'm physically exhausted, I'm jet-lagged, and I plop down at the Shabbos table with my wife and children, and my wife says, okay, one thing from the week you're grateful for, and I want to kill her. I want to kill her. But that's for other people. I don't mean that for us. Come on. She's wise, and she says, she smiles, and she goes around to the kids, and she shares something from the week that she's grateful for, and I'm going to pass. You know what comes popping in my head? I had forgotten about the wedding. I totally forgot about the wedding. And as I share with my wife and children the story of that amazing chasana, I feel it going from short-term memory to long-term memory, which is why I'm able to call on that memory fondly and with gratitude in a way that I never would have been able to otherwise. That's a count your blessing exercise. It's worth incurring the wrath of children and grandchildren to give it a shot. Because, again, that puts you in group three. Doesn't have to be something that is force, and you'll love it. You'll love it, and you can figure out a way to. For some people, it'll probably just makes you nauseous. Makes a lot of men nauseous, but that's okay. But, okay. Number three. Let's see. Yeah, I think I have time for three and four. Here's number three. Number three is another interesting Friday night recommendation. And it's tied to benching also, but it comes with the story. I use a lot of stories, even though I could bore you with a lot of studies. Stories go to your right hemisphere. Stories is exactly what, you know, Rav JJ just shared with you. What's the power of a Gadita? I remember the attitude towards the Gadita, but I was lucky to have a father who would give a shiur, Gemara shiur every Shabbos. He's the Rav of the White Shul in Far Rockaway. Thank God, is still going strong. So my father, he should live and be well, used to give a shiur that had a lot of people come. This Gemara shiur, actually, he still gives a shoot off of that shiur. With some people have been going to that shiur for 60 years straight. It's an amazing thing. That shiur still goes on in his home now, but it's an amazing thing. But I remember, I had this vivid memory that when it got to Chelek, that Gadita Gemara, filled with stories, hundreds of people would come. Literally, the Beis Medrash, you couldn't get seats. Because he was trained by Rosh Shlomo Hyman and Rosh Raga Feivel Mendelovich here in Torah Vadas, who knew how to teach a Gadita and knew how to bring out the deeper kinds of lessons of a Gadita, which marries the right hemisphere to the left hemisphere. I was, next time I see Rav Schechter, I'm gonna talk to him a little bit about some of the neuropsychology of this, which I think is fascinating, a fascinating way to look at the talk he just gave. But anyway, here's the third recommendation. There was a conference for families of children at risk who've left our way of life. And they had a panel Friday night, and the panel was filled with children who had never, who had gone totally off the derech, and their job, there were about six or seven of them, if I remember correctly, maybe seven or eight, their job was to say, what led to your leaving our way of life? And one after the other had a different story about what alienated them from our religion. But there was a common theme. So one said, you know what did it to me? I was abused. Nobody ever knew it. I felt terrible. I felt damaged. And then I found solace with equally marginalized peers. Another one said, I had an undiagnosed terrible chorea problem. And I felt dumb. And I felt like I couldn't be part of things. And nobody knew about it. And I just felt that I was disappointing my parents, my rebbeim. And again, I found solace with equally marginalized peers. Another would say, I grew up in a family whose bumper sticker was learn or die. Go to the finest yeshivas or else. And I had an undiagnosed attention deficit disorder. I just didn't have the zitzflesh to learn. And one after the other had a different story, same underlying issue, which is that their inner uniqueness wasn't recognized. So a Rav spoke that night. He was part of the program Friday night after the meal. Rabbi Brafman from Yeshiva Far Rockaway. And he said something which I thought was brilliant. He said he just noticed the parents who were benching the children that Friday night. He said, I don't have any easy answer for this problem. He says, but I have news for you. What I just heard from all those people who've left our way of life is that we somehow failed to recognize their uniqueness. And to the extent that what I saw was that as fathers, and in some cases mothers, benched their children Friday night, each child related to the parent in a different way. He says, here's my recommendation. It's a simple recommendation. As you bench your children Friday night, if you have that minhag, try to realize how they're relating to you, capture their uniqueness, and fan the flames of their uniqueness throughout the week. I know what he was talking about. Now, sometimes, remember I said before, the eye sees only what the mind knows. I had to go back home to my family. Sometimes I just spent Shabbos with my family, okay? And I go home, and I bench my kids. And I realize something I never saw. My oldest kid, my son, his warmth comes through when I bench him. Then comes a daughter, whose chain comes through. Then the next kid is very cuddly, my third child. And my fourth child, sense of humor comes through. Each child has uniqueness that as you tune into that at a Friday night bracha, it makes all the difference. It's a magnificent Rav Yeruchim Lubavitz that I love. Rav Yerucham, Mashgiach in pre-Holocaust Europe at the Mir, says the following. At the end of the Sefer we're learning, and Vayechi talks about the bracha that Yaakov gives, famously says, Ish Asher Kvi Bruchaso Berachosam, each son got a different bracha. And he says the following, brilliant, brilliant psychological insight. He's actually my favorite psychologist, Rav Yerucham Lubavitch. Here's what he says. He says, if you, when you bench your children, or you have wishes and aspirations for your children, if it's about your wishes and what you want and your unmet needs, not about their potential, but about you, he says, it's like taking a watering can and watering a plot of earth that has no seeds in it. He says, it's literally a bracha levatala. He says, in order for a bracha to take hold, the seed has to be there. The seed is the seed of their uniqueness and their potential. And if you don't do that, it's just not going to work. And that's the third recommendation in terms of thinking of ways to have gratitude, to have hakaras hatov for the unique spark of their child. I'll just share with you one last story on this and then come to the close. The last story is, I think I have permission to say it, I hope. But I think it's been picked up in Mishpacha magazine. So actually, I knew there was a reason why I say it. I first heard this privately. I'm friendly with one of Rav Volpe's sons. So Rav Volpe, a great rabbi who, the last generation, Yerushalayim, the author of Ali Shur, brilliant Baal Musar, has great stuff on gratitude I didn't share with you. Maybe I should have, but his stuff, his insights are amazing. So he lived this. And his son told me the following story. His son told me that his father was the head of a big yeshiva in Yerushalayim, a real yeshivish place. And his passion, Rav Volpe's son's passion, is he wanted to be a pilot. He wanted to be a pilot, I imagine, in the Israeli Air Force. He said his father insisted, if that's your dream and that's your passion, you have to follow. You don't mess around with the passion. And he pushed him to follow his dream. He said he used to come back on leave from the Air Force. He didn't want to embarrass his father. He'd have his rifle, and he'd be in his uniform, and he'd stand in the back of the Beis Medrash. And his father, who sat all the way up front, would come to the back, schlep his son to the front bench, front row, insist that he sit next to him. Can't even imagine how this must have looked back then. He said, but the thing that was most impressive to my friend was, he said his father didn't have to work on it. It was clear to him that his father was just proud of him. He wasn't working on himself on how to handle having this outlier of a son who other people would probably be checking their mezuzahs about. And because of that, what ended up happening to this son is he did a lot for the Israeli army. He became a pilot. He did all the things that we know such heroes do. And he then went and learned for many, many years in the top yeshivas in the world. Many years. And he went and he got smicha. He probably learned for many more years than he would have if he had not been allowed to pursue his dreams. And today he integrates the different parts of himself in a way that serves our community much in a much deeper way than had he been forced to follow his father's dreams and expectations instead of his own inner spark. It's a beautiful thought from Rav Nachman. He says, every Jewish child has a nigun miyuchad, an inner melody. And the job of Jewish leaders and Jewish parents is to nourish that nigun miyuchad, that unique melody. And when we do it, he says, an incredible symphony comes out. And I'll just end this part with a really beautiful quote, and then I'll give you my concluding story, and we'll end just on time. Here's the quote. It's a quote This quote is from Rav Kook. And I just love what he says about this aspect of having gratitude for the uniqueness of our child. Every person has to understand that in his inner essence, a flame is lit. No two people have an identical flame. Danish Shane Loner. There isn't a single person alive, as you'll hear in my last story, who doesn't have that flame that we have to nourish and nurture and be grateful for. We also have to raise our children and for ourselves know it's not enough to keep your inner fire to yourself. We have to share it with others. And to literally take our inner flame and set the world ablaze. It's an amazing, amazing imagery for how important this aspect of Hakaras HaTov is. And the art is to know it, look for it, and find it. Doesn't have to be the brilliance we're used to talking about. It doesn't have to be somebody who's some kind of Elui in learning or can get into an Ivy League school or whatever your dreams might be. It's usually about what's their unique gift. Everybody has it. We know it. We all know stories about it. This is an area I could go off on, but instead I'm going to end with my final recommendation, which is basically about how to overcome Hergel and Tefillah. A third of davening is supposed to be Hakaras HaTov. It's supposed to be gratitude. And you look at it. How do we do that? How do we overcome Hergel and Tefillah? And I think, again, almost every part of Tefillah, there are stories or personal experiences that we could relate to. Here's the story I'm going to end with. About 5-6 years ago, a group of Hasidim, I think it might have been Satmar Hasidim, I'm not sure, but a group of Hasidim started calling me and bugging me. They had an organization for children with severe developmental disabilities, severe cognitive and physical disabilities, very severe. And they have a Shabbos, a retreat every year. And they wanted me to come to give chizuk during the Shabbos. And I didn't want to go in the worst way. I thought to myself, I'm not going to feel comfortable. I don't want to subject my wife to this. To a chassid, I'm not exactly the model of somebody who they would necessarily be comfortable with. In fact, I really did not want to go. You know, I've been traveling too much. I love being home, as you know, right? I love being home. So they wore me down. They very sweetly called me every 3 months for 5 years. After 5 years, I just got too guilty, and I finally said yes. Of course, it became the high point Shabbos of the last 5 years. It's true, they saw me as different. One of them referred to me as Hasidei Umos HaOlam. Okay? It's true. Which is about right. From their perspective, they didn't mean it in a mean way. From their perspective, I was a righteous Gentile. So anyway, it's Friday night. We have a tish. We're singing, saying over stuff. I'm doing my thing. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and one of the Hasidim comes to me, and he says, before you go back to your room, do you mind if we meet? I'd like for you to meet with me and my wife. I said, sure, my pleasure. And I go to the corner of the hotel. And he tells me the following story. He said 8 years earlier, he had a daughter. And this daughter was born with severe, severe cognitive and physical limitations. It was clear she would never talk. She would never understand. He said, but for him, one of the worst parts was the nature of her illness. Well, she would never be able to sit up. She would have to spend her life, I guess because of some kind of spinal deformity, never really being able to sit up and be among people in a way that she could see them. He accepted it. When his daughter was about a year or 2 years old, he hears that there's a group of physical therapists in Europe who developed a physical therapy intervention that in a certain percentage of cases taught these kids how to sit up. He goes, I have to do my ishtavos, I have to try. Hops on a plane with his daughter, flies to Europe, they start working with her for a very long time. Turns out she looks like she's a responder, but he runs out of money and he runs out of time. He has other kids, he has his wife, and he begs them, he says, look, teach me how to do it. I can't afford to do this anymore. Because I'll do it in America. And they laugh and they say, you don't have that kind of education. You have to be a physical therapist. We're not allowed to teach you. But he persists, as I learned. This is a persistent group, these parents, probably part of what they learned with their optimism on how to get change going. He drove them crazy, and it turned out they also were righteous, okay, and whatever that means. And he wore them down. He taught them. They taught him how to do it to the extent that they could, a guy with no formal education. Since he flies back, teaches his wife how to do it, and he and his wife, he tells me, spend the next 6 years nonstop doing this physical therapy on the daughter. And then he comes to the purpose of asking to meet with me. He says, do you mind if I introduce you to my daughter? And I said, are you kidding? I'd love to meet her. And he calls to a counselor at the other end of the hotel, who pushes this clearly impaired 8-year-old girl who's in a wheelchair, but she's sitting up. She's sitting up. And she looks at the three of us, me and both her parents, and she flashes us a million-dollar smile, which we meet with tears of joy. And ever since that early Shabbos morning, I don't say the bracha of Zokev Kefufim with the same kavana. Anytime I say Zokev Kefufim, thanking God for the simple miracle of being able to stand in front of you and talk to you or sit up upright, I see it differently. Anisecha Shebechol Yomi Manu, to have gratitude for things we take for granted, be it light after electricity going off, warmth after not having heat for a couple of weeks, as so many of our family members in the Five Towns or Rockaway or in other parts of Brooklyn might have had, to be able to have gratitude for peace, which unfortunately, until today, our brothers in Eretz Yisrael haven't had, or to be able to have gratitude for everything in this shul, family, friends, and faith. So that's the message of today, the message of Hakaras HaTov. It's what the secular community around us is also celebrating, and it's an important message. It's an important message that if we could figure out a way to build up the habit of attention to what we have in the various ways that we've been discussing, I hope we'll all be zoche to truly be able to bring this midah into our lives in a meaningful way. Thank you so much for inviting me, rabbis and everybody. And then do that.
There'll be refreshments outside these doors, down the stairs to the left in the catering hall. There's some cake, cookies, and coffee. Thank you all for coming.